Hello, I'm Jason, and this is episode 14 of my photography podcast here at pointsinfocus.com. So let's see, we are picking up after a somewhat extended bit of a break, at least recording podcasts. Now, if you're not listening to this when it originally airs, then it probably isn't that much of a deal. But there is some backstory that fills in for the what I'm going to be talking about in this and a great number or several more upcoming podcasts. In the last 2 weeks of October, I went on a road trip around the southwest of the United States. Started and ended in Las Vegas, which I don't particularly care for Las Vegas. It's not my speed of place, if you will, but cheap to fly into and out of. So started and ended there and hit many of the major canyons in that area. So the Grand Canyon, Bryce, Zion, Antelope Canyon, Monument Valley. We drove to Durango and rode the Durango and Silverton Railroad and Mesa Verde. And then, you know, whatever was sort of on the roads in between, if you will. And I had been hinting at this for, I guess, a while. I don't normally talk about where I'm going and when I'm going to be out of the office or away from home. But, you know, I've been hinting at this because some of the things I wanted to talk about kind of needed a little bit of explanation. And for instance, I have episode 4 of this podcast was about F-Stop Gear's Ajna backpack. And why would I buy a new backpack, especially a hiking backpack, just on a lark, as opposed to because I was going somewhere where I would be hiking? I also talked about, I picked up a 5D Mark IV pretty much as fast as I could. And again, it was I didn't need, you know, if I hadn't had been where I was going to go and do this traveling and photography on it, I didn't need a 5D Mark IV that badly otherwise, and I wouldn't have needed to buy one. As much as I like digging into hardware, and and this is a big thing for me, but as much as I like digging into hardware and doing reviews and analysis kinds of things, the reality is I can't compete with DP Review or DxO Mark or the Digital Picture. I don't have great ties with Canon to where they send me cameras early. I'm very much in, you know, a regular Joe. When you can buy it, I can buy it. And when you can afford it, I can afford it. That it's not like there's a lot of, I think I find or I see a lot of people seem to think that, you know, if you're a big Canon fan or you do a lot of things, or even if you're like a Canon explorer of light, that translates to basically Canon giving you free gear. Or if you're a Nikon ambassador, Nikon just gives you all the gear that you need. And in talking to some of those guys, that's not really true. And it's certainly not really true for, or it's certainly not true for people like me who aren't an explorer of light and aren't affiliated with Canon directly and, you know, anything like that. I use Canon because it's the gear that works best the way for me. Not because they're paying me to say anything or they're paying me to have the gear. In fact, they've made quite a lot of money, relatively speaking, off of me buying their gear. But anyway, I wanted to talk. So, you know, when I got the bag and or the backpack and I got the camera, it's easy to, if you use something enough, and I don't mean like a specific camera, but if you use camera backpacks or you're familiar with SLRs or whatever, you can draw a number of inferences about how things are going to behave and perform and so on and so forth, and how useful things will be from your experience, that you don't necessarily need to have hard field time with something to know that it might not work for you or that it probably will work for you. On the flip side, the hard field experience really is the end-all, be-all, denominator factor, delineating factor, that you just can't get around it. All the supposition and all the experience-driven thought does not really hold a candle to the empirical use of actually having the bag or the camera or the piece of equipment, digging it out in the field for an extended period of time and using it. And, you know, so I talked in, like I said, episode 4 about my first impressions of the Ajna. And I talked a couple of other, in 2 other podcasts and an article about the 5D Mark IV. And now I have field time with both the Ajna and the 5D Mark IV. Of the 14 days we were on the road, 11 of those I was out hiking and shooting for some portion of the day. I was at least shooting, if not hiking, but I was, you know, working out of the backpack, or I was carrying the backpack and working out of the backpack, and I was taking pictures. So I have a good amount now of, I think, practical experience with both the camera and the backpack. And now I want to talk about how the theory meets practice, so to speak. So I'm going to start with the Ajna. The big picture is that the Ajna worked pretty much as how I expected it to be. The shortcomings that I thought I identified or felt were shortcoming, the things that I felt were shortcomings in my sort of initial assessments, I found to be still shortcomings. And the things that I liked, I think, worked out to be things that worked well. With that said, like I said, I have field experience with it. I have at least 4 or 5 days where I carried a full camera bag and hiking load, day hiking load, which for me worked out to be, with the full camera gear and hiking stuff, approximately 45 pounds before I started doing everything I possibly could to cut it down a little bit, 45 to 50 pounds before I could cut it down. And so this brings me to my big complaint with F-Stop Gear's Ajna, the shoulder straps. I don't know what they were thinking. I honestly just blows my mind that here's a company that's selling a 30-ish liter hiking pack camera bag. And they're selling it as a camera bag. They're not selling it as, oh, here's a hiking pack and you can put a camera in it, sort of. They're selling it as a expedition grade, hardcore outdoor camera bag that you can use for hiking and expeditions and stuff like that. And on the 2 smallest of their mountain series, the Ajna, and I can't remember what the next size down is, they have the thinnest, wimpiest shoulder harness and waist belt pads that I can imagine. To put some perspective, and like I said, this is being sold as a camera bag. So it's not like you're potentially going to just have a bunch of clothes in it. You're going to have camera gear in it. And I had, it'll mount, the Ajna that I have will mount their Large Pro ICU. Their Large Pro ICU is what I bought when I was going for this, you know, with the bag. It's what I'm using. And if I load the Large Pro ICU, I can have 2 bodies, 4 lenses, a flash, a teleconverter, batteries, a spare set of eyeglasses. That whole package, 2 gripped professional bodies and the lenses, including a 100 to 400, right there alone is 35 or 38 pounds. And I just don't understand the thin, wimpy shoulder straps. The Think Tank, who is my big bag and camera bag supplier, that they're who I sort of run to for camera bags when I'm looking for a camera bag. The smallest backpack I have from them is a Streetwalker Pro. And the Streetwalker Pro is about half or less the volume of, I mean, it's basically like half the volume of the internal camera unit I have. I can carry a camera with a lens attached, a couple of extra lenses, and a flash. And that's about all there's room for in the Streetwalker Pro. And that bag, the Streetwalker Pro, has significantly better padded shoulder straps than the F-Stop Gear Ajna does. And really, it's completely inexcusable. I bought supplementary add-on pads for the shoulder pads, because after taking a like 15-pound load of basically just water in bags and whatever random weight I could grab and walking a mile with it with the stock shoulder pads, my shoulders were sore. And this is with most of the weight put on my waist, the way you're supposed to have the weight distributed for this kind of backpack. That's how bad the shoulder straps are, in my opinion. And even with the supplemental shoulder pads, with 35 to 40 pounds of crap on my back for 3 or 4 hours, the reality is at the end of 3 or 4 hours of hiking up trails, I wanted the bag off. I wanted to take the bag off. I wanted to put it down. I wanted to stop. Now, I'm not the most super awesome outdoor hikey person, and it doesn't help that the places that we were are not at sea level, and I'm used to sea level and flat, and we were at not sea level and hilly. But that doesn't really change that I was looking for, you know, it doesn't really change the fact that I'm still carrying a heck of an amount of gear, and better padded shoulder straps would be better. And like I said, there is no level of underscoring on that point that I think I can make. I don't see the decision that they had to put lighter straps on the two lightest mountain bags as a good decision. And like I said, the extra pads that I bought helped, but the extra pads that I bought being something that you just wrapped around the regular shoulder pads, they had their own disadvantages in terms of, you know, they slid and you had to make sure they were in place before you put backpack on and so on and so forth. And, you know, even then, I don't think combined the regular pads plus the extra pads that I had would be or were as good as the heavier pads or the thicker pads that like Think Tank uses or that F-Stop Gear uses on their bigger backpacks. I mentioned, I think, in my original thing that I was a little concerned about the fabric. Well, concerned isn't the right word. The fabric and the backpack construction as a whole on its own was a lot lighter than I had expected it to be. That said, the fabric held up really well. I put the bag down in sand and dirt and on sandstone, rough sandstone. I put the bag down on sticks and twigs and pretty much didn't care. And, you know, when I got back and I inspected it, I saw no appreciable or visible wear in the surface finish on the material anywhere on the bag. So it may have felt light in my initial sort of inspection, but it certainly held up as a good quality thing. The final point, I didn't have a problem with this. I really should make a test of the water capacity or retention capacity or whatever. But I do have a philosophical issue with their hydration setup. In the Ajna, like I think most of their other bags, they're designed to be able to be used with like a Camelback hydration bladder or whatever the generic equivalent is. I have a 3-liter insulated bladder. This is, again, one of those things where I can put 3 liters in and have it if I need it. But if I don't have, you know, if I only had a 1-liter bladder and I needed to go somewhere where 3 liters was kind of what I wanted, I didn't have, you can't overfill it, basically. Or you can underfill a larger one, but overfilling a smaller one doesn't work. But anyway, F-Stop Gear's approach to where they put the hydration bladder is they put it in a pocket on the front, so it would be the side away from your back inside the main compartment. What else is in the main compartment? Well, if you're using it for a hiking pack, your clothes, your food, possibly your snacks, or, you know, depending on where you're hiking with it. I mean, if you're hiking in bear country, obviously, I don't think you want food in the bag, but, you know, your clothes, that kind of stuff. If you're using it with camera gear, your camera gear. Now, I don't think I'm the first person possibly to go, I don't know if it's a good idea to put water and camera gear in the same area. I did a bunch of research and I couldn't find an awful lot of any reports of Camel Black bladders, the bladder itself leaking. I could find, you know, some reports of people who had damaged O-rings on the lid or whatever, not having the lid properly secured where that leaked, but where the bladder itself was an issue, I didn't really find anything to indicate that that was a problem, which, you know, is one of those things where it's very much that kind of put my mind at ease. And there is a pocket that contains the hydration bladder in the backpack, but I still go back to the whole overall as a whole, I don't like the idea of having it in the main compartment. Instead, and I have yet to see anybody who actually does this, I think that the hydration bladder should be put on in a side pouch that's drained so that if it does leak, the water just runs out down your leg or whatever, and you know that your water's leaking. Has drainage and that is isolated and waterproof from the camera gear. Because here's the deal. I mean, push come to shove, I'm not expecting my hydration bladder to leak. But if it does, and it is in my bag with camera gear, I could potentially have, and it's not, you know, if you're talking a serious photographer and a couple of mid-range bodies and or a couple of high-end bodies and some big glass, it would not be difficult to have $15,000 or $20,000 worth of gear in there that could get wet. And that is not a situation that I think any camera bag maker should ever put their users in. I don't think you should have, like, they should not be designing a bag that is 100% dependent on your hydration bladder not to be a problem. Now, I did mention that it's in a pocket, and the pocket may be waterproof. I haven't tested that. It's something I really should test, which would tend to contain the water to a degree if it leaked. But there's still an issue of that only would work if the backpack's on your back and upright. If you take the backpack off and lay it on the ground, the water comes rushing out of that pocket potentially. And that again assumes that the pocket's waterproof. The pocket isn't waterproof, or the seam leaks or something like that. Again, you run into this, there is water in the same area as your camera gear. And I don't think that that's a good design. And this is a problem I would say that runs through at least up to the next tier from F-Stop Gear and possibly throughout their whole line. And like I said, I think that, so let me kind of wrap up, I guess, my thoughts on Ajna. I like it. It was, with the added padding, it was, I think, a much better option for what I was doing than carrying around one of my think tank bags. On top of that, it was quite nice to have a camera bag that didn't look like a camera bag at all. It looked like a hiking pack. I was a lot less concerned about it being theft or somebody going through it or whatever, because, you know, it just looked like a hiking pack. That's not to say that somebody wouldn't go through a hiking pack and, ooh, camera gear. But I didn't necessarily feel like I was easily singled out compared to all the other people with hiking packs. For the most part, I feel that the build quality and the feature set, especially the internal camera units, that being separate modular components, outweighed the issues that I had with the shoulder straps and with the water pocket pouch, hydration, however you want to put it. That said, I would really like to see F-Stop Gear go back to the drawing board and put the better or the heavier padded shoulder straps on all of their bags, remembering again that ostensibly they're being sold as camera bags and camera gear is heavy. And I would like to see them do something to have a more positive separation of camera gear from liquid hydration, you know, liquid, your hydration bladder. That said, I am hard pressed to say that I could find a similar but different pack out there. And I looked. I looked at Mindshift Gear. I looked at Low Pro. I looked at, you know, a whole bunch of people, a whole bunch of companies. Guru Gear, who's now part of somebody else that I can't remember. I looked at a whole bunch of companies and options, and it came down essentially to you had kind of hiking looking camera, kind of hiking looking camera bags that still looked a lot like camera bags and didn't have really great capacity for camera gear or whatever, and were big. You had big backpacks that were probably very comfortable from a like hiking long-term carry perspective, but very much looked like a camera backpack and not something else, and were big. Or you had F-Stop Pro, F-Stop Gear, their bags that look like hiking packs, but work really or are designed to be camera bags. And, you know, I talked about this in the previous thing that I was really big fan of the internal camera unit because those are a lot smaller potentially than the backpack as a whole and are sized well where, like, if you have a problem with getting on a plane and carrying the backpack on, you could take your camera gear out and carry that on and the extra, you know, whatever in the backpack you could check. So, you know, all told, my verdict is that I'm happy with the bag. There are things, I have nits that I would pick that I would be thrilled if F-Stop Gear actually addressed those, that I think they would make the bag a much better product overall, you know, the better isolation of water and so on and so forth. But at the same time, I don't feel like I messed up. I don't feel like I wasted my money on it. I don't feel like I should have got something else. And I do think that, you know, while I'm loath to say everybody should check out F-Stop Gear or whatever and buy their bags, I do think that their bags are worth a look if that's the kind of pack that you're, you know, you're looking for a more hiking style backpack for camera gear. And, you know, I mean, the nice thing is, I guess, when push comes to shove is I have a hiking pack now that even if I don't want to take camera gear, if I just want to take clothes and a tent and whatever, I have, I can pull the integral camera or the internal camera unit out and I can go hike with a 30-ish, I think it's a little more than 30 liters or it's around 30 liters, a 30-liter hiking pack with the frame and full suspension and the whole shoot and match and plenty of places to tie things on the outside if I need it to. So my initial sort of feelings on it, I think, were borne out. It's a nice bag, but it, like most things, has a few shortcomings that are could potentially be deal breakers for some people. So with that out of the way, and slightly longer than I had intended to ramble about my backpack, the F-Stop Gear Hajna, I want to talk about Canon's new 5D Mark IV. There is a lot that I could talk about, and maybe I should just make this entirely a separate podcast, but I don't think I'm going to. I think I'm going to just go with it as here and just recognize that this is going to kind of run long. There are so many things that I don't get about people and that I don't understand. And the 5D Mark IV, I think, is one of those places that exemplifies this kind of understanding issue that I have. Let me jump to the point. The 5D Mark IV, I am a still photographer. I shoot little bits of video every now and then because, in my opinion, the matter or the point is that video should, the point is to tell a story or convey something. And there are times where video does that better than a still, and there are times where a still is what you really want. From a, you know, personal interest perspective, I'm not a big video guy. I do not consider a DSLR to be video camera first and foremost, and for all kinds of reasons, namely that you need to put almost as much of the cost as the cost of the DSLR into accessories to make it ergonomically and functionally equivalent to, you know, a video camera. So there's that thing. But like I said, primarily I'm a still photographer. My interest is still photography. My interest is prints. I don't begrudge video people. I think broadly speaking, the more features that go into the camera and the more markets it caters to, the better off I am as a user. And I say that because, you know, when first video started coming into SLRs, there was a lot of people that I saw online that bemoaned this new video stuff, and it was coming in and it was displacing stuff, and it was, you know, that was their feeling. It was displacing features and it was making cameras more complicated and so on and so forth, and possibly ruining image quality. And that's possibly true. I mean, if the money that Canon's put into, the money that Canon's put into video features, they had put into better still performance, we might have better still cameras from Canon than, you know, we have. That said, the counterpoint to that is there's a lot of people who are buying these cameras for video. And it, in a market that is like SLRs, a market that is not huge growth potential, and it's not a huge market and, you know, on its own, period. There are only so many serious photographers or mid-range videographers who, well, speaking from photography specifically, there are only so many serious photographers who are willing to put $3,500 into a camera. There's a lot of people who just can't afford that. And there's a lot more people that just don't care about photography as an art or a hobby or a field enough to even want to do that. This is the argument that, you know, comes up about cell phones and how cell phones are destroying the SLR industry. Well, maybe, but until you can change lenses on a cell phone and it has a full frame sensor, it's not really comparable to the SLR or the high-end SLR industry. But being that there's only so many people that are in a position to and are willing to spend money on these high-end SLRs, there's certain costs associated with the design and the engineering and so on and so forth. And the bigger the market that Canon can make for these cameras, or Nikon or Sony or whoever, the better off we are, even as a still photographer, kind of along-ish for the ride. That, you know, if Canon would sell, say, 50,000 5D Mark IIIs to just still photographers, and they sell another 50,000 to videographers, that's 50,000 cameras that they hadn't sold, and that's a market that they, you know, if they can expect to see those kinds of sales, that's a market that they can amortize more R&D work over. So my feeling, like I said, is that the broader the appeal of the camera can be made, the better it is for us as consumers, because while it may not be the most awesome or the highest resolution SLR or the highest dynamic range SLR or the best video camera on the market, there are a lot of people that are like me that are not super specialist photographers or videographers in one area. So why am I rambling about all of this stuff? It comes down to the overwhelming discussion that I continue to see kind of online about the 5D Mark IV, that it's not a really good camera. And unequivocally, that is just patent nonsense. And I don't know where that comes from. I have no idea where the sort of persistent, it's not all that great mantra that I have seen come up over and over and over again in discussion forums and discussions about the camera is what basis that has in reality. Fact is, I don't think it has a basis in reality. I think it's just people whining because they like to whine. But the sort of, I mean, I guess the best way I could put it is to compare it to like the Nikon D500 and D5, which neither of them are direct competitors to the 5D Mark IV, but the overall philosophy, I think, between what Nikon is doing in those cameras or has done in those cameras and what Canon's doing in the 5D Mark IV and where the market or where the online discussion comes from. And it really boils down to this. On the Nikon D5 and D500, Nikon pushed a lot of marketing hype for what's not ostensibly all that much bark or bite behind it. There's a lot of bark and the bite is kind of eh. Now, that's not to say that the D500 or D5 are shit cameras and Nikon should be abandoned and blah, 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 blah. No. What I'm saying is, for example, autofocus. Nikon put out a new autofocus system. They advertise it with 153 or something like that autofocus points. But when you get down to it, only 55 of those can be selected by the user to focus. And when you go and you look at the coverage isn't tremendously different from what you get in a Canon 5D Mark IV. It's a little wider in some respects. It's not as wide in other respects. And when you start getting into ancillary points, like autofocus at f8, the 5D Mark IV does that over the entire frame, assuming you have the right lens and teleconverter combinations. The D5, Nikon D5 and D500 only do it over the tiny central subset of the frame. And, you know, you could make an argument about, you know, kind of either way. But the point I'm trying to make is Nikon's numbers are huge. But when you actually sort of read into them, it's a lot more the same. Or not when you read into them, but when you actually get down and to the practical nitty gritty, it's a lot more the same, but with a whole lot of marketing flash. Canon didn't really change the numbers with respect to the autofocus system. There's still the same number of points on the 5D Mark IV as there was in the 5D Mark III and the 1DX Mark I. What changed is the coverage is better, focuses at f8 is, you know, now cover the whole sensor is f8 capable. But that's not the kind of big number that sells opinions on boxes. You could say the same thing about ISO performance or ISO numbers. I won't say performance, I'll say numbers. The D5 made this huge splash of a discussion. It goes out to ISO 3.2 million. And the D500 goes up to 1.6 million. And big numbers, sounds impressive. You know, the total ISO range of the D5 goes from 50 to 3.2 million. It's like 15 or 16 or 17 stops or something like that of ISO range. The 5D Mark IV goes from 50 to 100,000. And the 5D Mark III went from 50 to 100,000. That there really is no function, you know, there's really no difference between the Mark III and the Mark IV if you look at the numbers on the box. The only real difference is the base ISO on the Mark IV went from 25,600 to 32,000, so a third stop higher base ISO. But that's it. The range didn't really change. And the marketing, if you just look at it, the marketing would imply that Canon hasn't really done anything. And Nikon has like just gone through the roof and turned things up to 11 and delivered the awesome. However, if you go and you play with a D500 or you play with a D5 or you just go look at the performance numbers from DxOMark, the way Nikon turned up the ISO as high as they did was by letting the image quality go to hell. And I played with a friend of mine's D500 while I was helping him set it up in set up Lightroom for it. And ISO 1.6 million is completely unusable on his D500. In fact, and this is sort of not apples to apples, obviously, but in fact, if I shoot at ISO 100,000 on my 5D Mark III, and I boost it the 1, 2, 3, 4 stops to 1.6 million, I get a better image out of my 5D Mark III than he gets out of his D500. D600 at the same equivalent ISO setting of 1.6 million. And, you know, I know there's somebody who's probably hearing that and going, yeah, but the 5D Mark III is a full frame camera. Uh-huh. And it also is a garbage sensor. The 5D Mark III had one of the worst, when it was released, had one of, if not the worst, full frame sensor in terms of noise and dynamic range of any of its competition on the market. That it was very much a poorly performing camera. And it still has more than a stop, more than a third of a stop of dynamic range at the equivalent of ISO 1.6 million. But like I said, the point here isn't so much to rag on Nikon. The point is that I've seen a number of discussions online with people whining about how the 5D Mark IV is not that good of a camera. And I think, and I could be entirely speculating, but that most, if not all of those people don't own one, don't have one, haven't used one, and are looking at numbers on the box in marketing speak and not actually evaluating performance and performance data. Because performance data for the 5D Mark IV is really good. It is not, I will say right away, it is not necessarily class leading in any single possible respect, with the exception of being a 7 frame per second, 30 megapixel camera. I don't know offhand what the frame rate of the Sony a7 R2 is, but that might be the closest competition. The D810 certainly is slower than it. But, you know, when push comes to shove, the deal isn't that it has to be class leading. The deal is that it has to be good enough. And there's certainly nothing wrong with being in the wins a few, loses a few tier. That it's, you know, everybody, I think a lot of people get caught up with camera equipment or computer equipment or whatever on what is the best in some arbitrary single standard and not, or spec, and not necessarily how things perform as a package as a whole. So, you know, yeah, the 5D Mark III is beaten by the D810 and the Alpha A7 R2 in resolution. It's the lowest resolution of the three cameras. It's also pretty much not, I won't say the best, but it's kind of not neck, you know, it's neck and neck for dynamic range to a certain degree. It wins in some ISOs, it loses in others. The Nikon D810 certainly does much better at ISO 64 and ISO 100 than the 5D Mark IV does, but then it kind of falls off at higher ISOs, and not that the 5D Mark IV doesn't. But even in terms of dynamic range, even where the 5D Mark IV loses, it's not losing by a stop or two stops. It's losing by less than a half a stop in most cases. And in some cases, less than a third of a stop, which essentially comes down to being, it's not worth talking about the loss or the gain or the win. They're essentially meaningless differences. So what does this mean as someone who uses the camera? Well, like I said, I'm coming to the 5D Mark IV from a 5D Mark III, which never was the greatest camera out there. I have used my Mark III as my primary camera for the last 4 years since I got it, since 2012 when it was released. And so I've been, you could say, photographically depressed that or repressed. That I have been sort of stuck on the bottom end of Canon's situation, you know, performance, however you want to put it. Everybody else was doing better, and I was stuck at the bottom. So that's sort of, I guess, I'm pointing this out mostly to give some perspective on where I'm coming from. If you've been shooting Nikon or Sony, I don't know why you'd care really about the 5D Mark IV that much. And you're probably also saying, yeah, welcome to the world that we've been in for the last 4 years. And you know what? It's nice to be here. Thank you. But so where's the deal? So the IQ, I am just routinely and massively impressed by on the 5D Mark IV. I have images. I shot a ton of my work at on this trip at ISO 100, possibly to my detriment because of something, some other things that I'll get into with respect to shutter speeds and so on and so forth. But at ISO 100, I found that I am able to dig out shadow detail and raise shadows to levels that never were possible for me in the past. That I could take an image that otherwise I would have had to shoot as an HDR, and I can bring the shadows up and have nice detail. It's not always 100% clean if I lifted it a lot, but have nice detail in the shadows that I have elevated. The noise is also extremely well controlled, at least from my perspective. And so what is my perspective on that, I guess, is in 2015 in the spring, I went to Alaska, and during that trip, one night was sitting out on a balcony on our cruise on the boat, and we were going down one of the channels, and there was just waterfalls all over the place. And I decided to take some pictures of them because why not? It was 9 o'clock at night. It was still light. It wasn't the greatest light, but it was still light, and I could go out and I could take pictures, you know, sit there and take pictures of waterfalls. So I'm shooting waterfalls with a 100 to 400 at 400. I think I had a teleconverter on it too. So 520 at F8, basically. And I'm on a boat that's moving. And yeah, the lens has image stabilization, but image stabilization can only compensate for so much. So to get a reasonable shutter speed, I was shooting it between ISO 1600 and ISO 3200. And I had expected that those images, I would come home or I would put on my computer and I would go, okay, they're nice pictures of waterfall and boy, I'll remember these. And that would be sort of it. And when I came home, I was kind of in that mood, but I decided that I was going to print one just on a lark as an A3 plus print to see, you know, how it came out. You know, maybe it come out good. Maybe it didn't. I don't know. You know, wouldn't know until I tried it. So I printed one and it came out and it was reasonably acceptable. There was some noise in it. The color wasn't as good as it would have been if it, you know, I had really good daytime light instead of post sunset twilight. But, you know, it was a reasonable picture and it pushed up my confidence in where I could go with the 5D Mark III. Fast forward to this trip. And like I said, I was at the Durango in Silverton. And in Durango, in the Roundhouse, they have a museum where you can go in. And one of the things in the museum is one of their engines that's out of service right now, 478, is set up with a stairway so that you can climb up and you can walk into the cab of the engine. And if you've any way interested in sort of industrial stuff, is an art thing, the pipes and valves and gauges and that kind of thing, the back head of a steam engine is great fodder for photography. So I climbed up in the engine and was shooting. Now, start with, roundhouses are not lit like sports fields. They're pretty dark. And steam engines are, you know, enclosed. They have windows. They are not, you know, outside. So even if the roundhouse was really well lit, the engine would still be pretty dark. And they didn't have the engine lit to, like, phenomenal levels. To get hand-holdable, so fast forward, I guess, or long story short, to get hand-holdable exposures, you know, reasonable shutter speeds of 80th to 125th of a second in the cab of the steam engine in the museum in the roundhouse, I was shooting at f2.8 and ISO 12,800. And again, the back of my head, I was thinking, though, these will be nice kind of look at on the phone, my phone or my computer or whatever, but they're going to be crap. They're not going to be good pictures. And come home and I decided to print one again, lo and behold, to see what happens. And I printed one and this is ISO 12,800 and I got a fantastic, well, I won't say fantastic, a completely acceptable by my standards prints. Yes, there is some noise in the shadows that is obviously not going to go away. And if I made it bigger than 13 by 19, it might have been more of an issue. I don't know because I can't print bigger than 13 by 19. But the short of it, or the long of the short of it, is that the combination of 30 megapixels and the new sensor in the Mark IV has pushed the ability, or pushed, allowed me to push my ability to make prints from images that are two to three stops higher ISO than I could with the Mark, or I was comfortable with the Mark II. Not to say that I couldn't, but I was never comfortable with those, the quality of those prints. And that's kind of the situation that I'm seeing with the camera. Now, for whatever reason, if you go look at DxO Mark and you compare the 5D Mark III and the 5D Mark II, the Mark III isn't that much better at ISO 12,800 than the Mark II is. I don't know why or what the deal is yet. In the practical experience of the prints that I have made, it is. I think a lot of it comes down to resolution. I think a lot of it comes down to the extra 8 megapixels or 8-ish megapixels makes the noise that much finer grained and that much less obnoxious to me as, you know, in a print. But across the board, image quality coming out of the camera, I have been massively pleased and impressed with the level of shadow recovery that I could make, the amount I could drag things up, the amount I could fix exposures without making images unacceptably noisy, the amount of dynamic range that I can, that was actually captured and could be usably compressed into something that I could, you know, print and look at, and the like I said, noise performance at high ISOs. Video, I shot a couple minutes of video, but I don't really have anything to sort of compare it to or contrast it against or whatever, so I can't offer at this time any, you know, comments on the video per se. The other big feature in the Mark IV that I was really looking forward to was the GPS. When I was in Alaska and coming back, I realized that I was extremely frustrated by the fact that I had pictures of mountains or whatever, and I had no idea where I took them. I knew I took them on a certain date, and I knew that they were taken kind of in some given area, but I couldn't track or trace or tell what specific, or where specifically I was taking these, you know, took those pictures. I couldn't tell you what the mountains were because I couldn't take a GPS thing and look up the mountains on a map and, you know, say, oh, that was Mount so-and-so and that's Mount such-and-such. Just couldn't do it. And that frustrated the heck out of me from a OCD need-to-know information level. So GPS, and I did an article and a podcast and a bunch of stuff talking about how to do GPS or how I was going to try and do GPS and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, the one thing that I did underscore is that the best possible, single best possible option of GPS is to have it built into the camera and doing its thing, and you don't need an extra widget and you don't need to try and sync things in after the fact. You just, boom, done, off you go. Turn it on, take a picture, and it's tagged. And that was, like I said, a big selling point for the Mark IV for me. In fact, it was such a big, GPS is such a big point that I was seriously, before the Mark IV got it, was announced, I was seriously trying to figure out how to get a 1DX Mark II because it has GPS capabilities as well, and built-in GPS capabilities. So adding GPS to the equation, then the next question is what does it do to your battery life? Because, I mean, obviously, if it's constantly running, something, you know, is drawing power, and that could possibly be an issue. Now, in the camera, Canon has three modes, off, mode one, and mode two. In mode one, the GPS is off whenever the camera is asleep and or turned off, and in mode two, the GPS is off only when the camera is turned off, but when it's asleep, the GPS continues to function for track logging and to keep updated information. And then on top of that, you can specify a track log interval if you're going to do track logging, which I did. You can specify a track log interval from, I think the minimum is like 15 seconds or something like that, and the maximum is like every 5 minutes. I used 2 minutes as my track log interval because I didn't need something more precise than that inherently. And the reality is when I was driving, if I was driving, the track log would be every basically 2 miles, because on average, the roads were 60 miles an hour. So every 2 miles, I would have an update. And when I was walking, walking as a photographer is not a very fast-paced thing. You're constantly looking at things and seeing if there's a picture. So, you know, I maybe had a track point every 100 feet or so. In fact, I probably had track points, you know, on average, the like accuracy level of GPS, like 30 meters or 10 meters or something like that in a lot of cases. So the question is battery life. And I don't have a number per se, but over the trip, I shot approximately 3,200 images, I think is the number, if I remember correctly, and about 10 minutes of video. I ran the track logging approximately 8 to 10 hours a day. I would turn my camera on when I got up in the morning and was going out the door at the hotel, and I would turn my camera off when I got back at the end of the day, basically after dinner. So like from 7 a.m. roughly, we'll just say, or 8 a.m. roughly till like 7 or 8 o'clock at night. So, you know, maybe 8 to 12 hours daily. And I was always running the track log, like I said. Every 2 minutes, it logged a track point, even when the camera was asleep, but not when the camera was off. Of that, I changed batteries twice. Now, I guess I have to throw out a couple of details here. I have a battery grip on my camera, so it's two batteries per change, so to speak. And I have only one LP6N, or whatever the new one is. All of my batteries that I used on this trip were the older LPE6. I think that's what it is, but you know, I didn't write it down either. They're the same batteries that are used by the 5D Mark III, or that were sold with the 5D Mark III and the 70D. And so I was using these LPE6 batteries. The difference between the 6s and the 6Ns is the 6s are 13 watt hour and the 6Ns are 14 watt hour. So, I mean, that's not a huge difference, but it is a difference. Plus, like I said, my batteries are old. They're 4 years old. They date back to when I got my 5D Mark III, and they're pretty heavily used. And I don't believe they get all four of my batteries have Canon's one red star or whatever in the battery health thing, indicating that they're not getting good performance anymore or the expected performance anymore. And I just can't bring myself around to doing anything about it because it doesn't seem that the performance I don't see an issue with. Anyway, so total of 26 watt hours with two batteries in the camera per shot. Theoretically, in practice, it was probably less than that. I changed batteries twice over the course of the trip. The first time I changed batteries was on day 4 or 5, and the second time I changed batteries was on day, I think, 9 or 10. And both times I changed batteries, I still had 40% left. 40% charge left for the camera. So 20% in each battery, because again, two batteries. So that works out to be 40% total charge. So I'm fairly impressed with the GPS in terms of power consumption. Or at least I'm not trashing the GPS with respect to power consumption. Like I said, it ran 8 to 12 hours a day, and I shot 3,200, 3,000 something like that pictures. And I basically was burning through 6 or 7 watt hours a day, or less. No, less than like 3 or 4 watt hours a day in power, taking pictures and running the GPS. So I was, like I said, very happy to see that there didn't appear to be a significant impact in battery life on using the GPS or running the GPS. And that's kind of, I think I've rambled now again for an hour like usual. And I think that's like, there's a lot of places where I need to sit down and do some, you know, a lot more detailed discussions. I will eventually have a review for 5D Mark IV just because there's a lot of stuff that's really handy and functional and worth talking about as a, you know, in more detail than just a, this is, I had the camera and I used the camera and whatever. The bottom line though, for me is, if you're a Canon photographer that's serious level, you know, either hobbyist, semi-pro or whatever, the Mark IV is the camera to have, unless you're shooting a 1D X Mark II. But the Mark IV is, the dynamic range is there, the noise performance is there, the frame rate's there, the autofocus system's there. It just hits on so many points. Even the video quality, from the little bit of video I shot, the quality of the video was pretty solid. Even the 5 or the 4K bit that I recorded accidentally, that was absolutely massive. And then I was wondering what happened to all my storage space on my card after recording a minute of video. But even that, though, is a discussion point on Canon could have either delivered low quality 4K video or big files. And Canon clearly decided to go with big files. They also decided to go with the DCI 4K format, which is a larger, higher resolution, wider aspect ratio than the Ultra HD that everybody else seems to have gone with. And again, I can't say, I don't have enough experience with video and with Canon, the 5D Mark IV's video in specific, to really be able to say one way or another that they made the right choice or they totally screwed up on it. So, I guess there's that to some degree, but the 1080p video that I was looking at of mine was perfectly reasonable. It was better quality than the video off my Mark IV, at least on first glance, or at least equal quality off of the video, or not Mark IV, Mark III, at least equal quality. That it certainly wasn't obviously worse. The high frame rate at 720p, it would have been nice to have 120 frame per second at 1080p, but, you know, I guess it is what it is. But the high frame rate is kind of nice to have for certain things. But, you know, as a whole, I don't understand the negativity towards the camera. The camera is fantastic. And I'm not saying that because, like I said, I don't get gear from Canon to talk about that. I don't get any money from Canon or anybody else to say that their gear is any good. I just have, you know, you could ask anybody that knows me. Since I got back from this trip that I've talked to in person, I have not been able to stop talking about how much better this camera is than my previous Canon gear. Again, if you've got Sony or Nikon gear, you know, there's no reason to switch that I can see. But as a Canon shooter, I now feel like I have tools that put me very much in the running, or a tool that puts me very much qualitative in the running competitively with Sony and Nikon. And, you know, when push comes to shove, the Mark IV is, along with the 1DX Mark II, the 80D, and the EOS M5, are Canon's first generation of sensors with on-chip analog digital converters. And they're competing with sensors from Sony and Nikon who have been doing on-chip analog digital conversion for at least 4 or 5 years, and they're not losing. And that, you know, to me either says that the next generation in a couple of years from Canon is going to be way ahead, possibly could be way ahead, because if they could catch up basically on the first generation parts, then the potential really exists for them to make some gains second generation. Or, you know, we're going to be seeing sort of another round of explosion in camera performance, which would be good for all of us. I mean, regardless of brand, is you know, if everybody starts getting or making sensors that are appreciably better, we all win, I think. But anyway, like I said, I've rambled now for over an hour on this, and I'm going to stop rambling because my throat is starting to hurt again. I appreciate the listen. Thanks for tuning in, and until next time.